Well, good evening, good afternoon, good morning, wherever you are around the planet. This is Len Wasanik for Black Op Radio with my co-host, Anita Langley.
Hello, everyone.
And it's great to be back, a sunny day today. Today we're doing show number 176.
Yeah, we're getting up there, aren't we?
Yeah.
We have Donald Scott with us today. This is a very interesting interview coming up, I'm sure. Very disturbing as well. We're going to be talking about mycoplasma and a rather nasty version of the beast as I'm hearing it and about it and reading about it in this paper. Are you there, Mr. Scott? Can you hear us okay?
Yes, I am, Anita. Thank you very much. And hi, Len.
Great. Glad you could join us.
Perhaps you could take us back a little bit and let us know, just let our listeners know how you came to be researching this.
Well, I am 80 years old. Let's start with that. And I was in the Canadian Navy for a number of years during the war, and after the war I went to the University of Toronto, have a Bachelor of Arts from Toronto, and then took a Master of Science from Guelph University, and then a Master of Arts from Laurentian University, taught high school and taught university, and then retired way back in, 20-some years ago now. And when I was 71 years old, I was quietly minding my own business, and the phone rang, and a lady on the phone said, "Professor Scott, you don't know me, but I am ill, and I need help." And I said, "Well, how about coming over to our apartment and bring any documentation with you, and we'll go over whatever your problem is, and I'll see if I can help you." I had a bit of a reputation as a something of an ombudsman in the community, and I got calls like this every now and again. Well, anyway, this lady came over the following Saturday morning, 9 o'clock. She brought a briefcase with her that was bulging with papers, and I said to her, "Well, now, what is your problem?" And she said, "I have chronic fatigue syndrome." And I had to admit that I really didn't know anything about chronic fatigue syndrome. But I was willing to listen to her, and I asked her what that meant, and she described this terrible illness, an absolutely unimaginable illness for those people who don't know what really goes on in a victim of chronic fatigue syndrome. Her extreme fatigue, her nausea, her night sweats, her weakness, and her emotional distress so much of the time. And I said, "Well, this is a medical problem, and I'm not a medical doctor." And she said, "Well, it's more than a medical problem." She said, "The trouble is, sick as I am, my employer is bullying me very badly. My union is neglecting me. The insurance company won't pay my short-term disability allowance that I applied for. The Human Rights Commission of Ontario has double-crossed me." And I said, "My goodness, this is a terrible way to use someone who is ill." And I said, "Can you substantiate this?" And she said, "Oh, very much." And she began producing the letters that she had accumulated over the couple of years that she had been ill. And every word she said was true. Her employer bullied her. Her union neglected her. Her insurance company cheated her. And the doctors, worst of all, so many medical doctors were dismissive or admitted that they knew nothing about what was going on to make her feel so terrible. And she was about to lose her home to the bank because she couldn't pay her mortgage. And I said, "Well, certainly I will help you in every way I can." And together we went to work, and we got her a couple of pensions, one from the teacher's pension plan and one from the Canadian government, and we got her a beautiful apartment in a co-op housing project where she only paid $140-some a month, light and heat included, for a nice apartment, And we got the insurance company to make a cash payment of $50,000 to her. Now, as we were going through the processes of getting justice for this very sick lady, I set out at the age of 71, and that's back in 1995, I set out to find out what is chronic fatigue syndrome, and how is it that society can be so dismissive of this disease? How is it that medical doctors don't know beans about it on average? And how is it that people can be so badly pushed around by bureaucrats in government and insurance companies and so on? That was the beginning of my studies. Now, let me explain. I had taken a Master of Science degree from one of Canada's better universities. I took that degree when I had a sabbatical, and I was not a scientist, and I didn't pretend to be. But when I got a chance to take a sabbatical, I thought, why go back to university and study more of the same old stuff you've been studying all your life? So instead of taking more in English literature and history, which had been my specialty, I signed up for a course as Master of Science. And I wanted to do that to shake up my neurons, to get my mind thinking in new channels, because I was sure there was an awful lot that I was missing, and this was one way to open a few more doors. So I was able to put to work this Master of Science discipline that I had taken a few years before. I collected data. I sorted the data into categories. I related one category to another. I formulated hypotheses. I designed tests to test those hypotheses. I conducted the tests. I gathered the evidence and weighed it against the hypothesis and either confirmed the hypothesis or changed it. And lo and behold, it wasn't very, very many months into this study that I started back in 1995 that I didn't discover a whole lot of terrible things about our medical profession in the world today, speaking primarily of Western medicine. I learned that there was a whole area of medicine that was severely warped by what had been going on over the last 50 years. And what was it that was going on? Well, the governments of Canada, United States, Great Britain, Australia, Israel, and South Africa had been working ever since the end of World War II to follow up on biological warfare research that they had been doing during the war. And I learned that the United States especially was very, very criminal in this. Talk about a terrorist nation. The United States, at the end of World War II, took the senior Japanese researcher and biological weapons researcher, Dr. General Ishishiro, of the Japanese Imperial Army, and they recruited him to work for the Americans. Here was the leader of Japanese imperial biological research who had killed hundreds, if not thousands, of Allied prisoners of war being employed by the United States government. And I also learned that they did the same thing in Germany in spades. They sent over certain qualified people to interview German researchers who had been conducting biological research on prisoners in Auschwitz and other places. And of these gangsters that had been testing terrible weapons on innocent victims, they recruited about 900 of them. And some of them they put into American Army uniforms and flew them back to the United States and put them to work. There was, for example, a guy they called the Butcher of Bucharest. Now, he was a Nazi who was in charge of the Gestapo's prison camps for Jews in Bucharest. This man had committed terrible atrocities. He was hired by the United States government, and under various kinds of disguises and aliases and all the rest of it, he was never unemployed for the rest of his life. He was not prosecuted for his war crimes. He was put to work helping the United States especially. Now, I say especially because the United States was not alone. Canada had their part in it. South Africa had their part. Israel had their part. But especially the United States, they went to work to develop two kinds of biological weapons. One kind of biological weapon would be lethal. It would be a weapon which in their own literature they describe as refractory to the human immune system. And the other weapon was to be disabling. It was refractory to the human immune system, but would not kill the victim. And we learned that the lethal weapon was what we now know of as the cofactors that cause AIDS. And the disabling weapon was the disease biological agent that causes, among other things, chronic fatigue syndrome. And is a cofactor with the Vizna virus that causes AIDS. Now, why did the United States and its allies want two types of biological weapon? The real truth is this, and I have evidence in spades. The truth is this: they knew that they could disperse the cofactors that present as AIDS among the black and brown people of the third world, and they could kill 8,000 people a day as they're doing this very day, and as they did yesterday, and as they'll do again tomorrow, because who in the heck cares about black and brown people in the third world? Very, very, very few. But they could not kill off 8,000 white people in Canada, United States, Britain, Australia, West Germany, because there would be a revolution if 8,000 people a day were being killed in those countries. They could only disable them. And we have the documentation to back up everything we say. And we have done our research from a scientific point of view. We know how they work. We have done it from a personnel point of view. We know who did it. We did our research in a political sense. We know which politicians, including that arch gangster Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, and Nelson Rockefeller, and we also know the military involvement and their great desires to maintain economic control of vast resource areas in Africa without having to bother about a whole bunch of Africans. And we did the research in all of these areas through the Common Cause Medical Research Foundation, and we have evidence which we can present to anybody in any court of law or any form of public opinion. We can produce the evidence piece by piece, step by step, person by person, and we can demonstrate clearly to the world that chronic fatigue syndrome, which led this tragic lady to come to me way back in 1995, and the disease mirror image of chronic fatigue, the disease called AIDS, we can take people and we can show them where it comes from, how it works, who did the work, who paid for it, who's benefiting from it. And that is where I am at this moment, and I thank you for the opportunity to talk to you and your listeners, because this is the greatest crime in the history of mankind. And the number of people in churches and in universities and in philosophic societies and in political parties who do nothing about this, they have their blinders on so they can only look straight ahead, not look to the right or to the left, and they can ignore the fact.
Okay, Donald.
Yes.
I'd like to ask you a few questions here,
sure,
because I can see this is going to go on. Very interesting topic. Now, I'd like to know what you think about the Gulf War Syndrome and Fort Detrick. I mean,
Absolutely. Well, Fort Detrick, of course, was established a number of years ago as a U.S. Army fort in northern Maryland. And in 1942, when the United States, Britain, and Canada united their efforts to create biological weapons, they decided to center their activities on Fort Detrick.
You're listening to Black Op Radio.
And it became the center of American research with a lot of Canadian and a lot of British input in a number of different ways. And some of the work was farmed out by Dietrich up here to Canada and some over to Britain and some to Israel and so on. So we know Fort Detrick very, very well. And we know the work that went on there. And are able to talk with you about any aspect of that you'd like to raise.
With regards to these ethnic-specific weapons, what I'm thinking about Gulf War Syndrome...
All right. Now, the Gulf War Syndrome, the thing is this, that when the Allies invaded Iraq in the first Gulf War, there were a number of factors that were at work which have never been fully and totally explained. One of the factors involved biological warfare weapons directly. Now let me explain what that factor was. Back in the 1980s, 1982 and 83, 84, 85, when Ronald Reagan, the late president, and his vice president George Bush Sr., were in the White House and in the power in Washington, they wanted to assist Iraq in defeating Iran in the war that Iraq started by invading Iran when Iran was in the midst of a revolution. So they brought the chief medical biological warfare researcher from Iraq over to the United States, over to a place called Plum Island, a small island just to the north of Long Island, and just about 10 or 12 miles off the shore of Old Lyme, Connecticut. And on Plum Island, they trained this gentleman from Iraq in the disease agent called the mycoplasma. Now, mycoplasma is a technical medical term, and it means a particle of living organism, which isn't completely living. That sounds a little contradictory, but you'd understand what I mean if we had more time to look at those details. The mycoplasma is a particle of bacterial DNA, Now, the DNA is the blueprint that a living organism uses when it reproduces itself. And there's a bacteria called Brucella abortus, and it derives mainly from cattle. Some sheep get it and some pigs get it, but essentially Brucella abortus is a cattle disease. And in 1942 and on, at Fort Detrick and in Great Britain, Porton Downs, they were working with brucellosis, which is the overall name of the disease agent, and they were working especially with the species called Brucella abortus. Now, they learned how to take that bacteria, and they learned how to remove what they called the disease active principle. That is the part of the bacteria which, when it got into a cow and or into a human being, caused the cow or the human being to become ill. They learned how to take that disease active principle in a crystalline form and discard the rest of the bacteria. Now, when it is removed in the crystalline form, it's called mycoplasma. And the thing is about the mycoplasma is in one state, it is like an inert crystal. It's like a particle or a crystal of salt or sugar lying on the table. But when it goes into solution, it comes back to a participator in life processes. And it is at that balance point between inert crystals and living organic material. So, in Plum Island, they were able to take the Brucella abortus, remove the Mycoplasma fermentans, which is one of the species of mycoplasma that was derived from the abortus, and they were able to have it in crystalline form and spread it to people by aerosol, spray it on them, or by putting it into the food chain, or by infecting insects. Now, for example, they learned they could adapt the mycoplasma fermentans to be contaminate mosquitoes. So they could take millions of mosquitoes and they could contaminate them, and then they could put them into a large carrying vehicle of some kind. In some cases the vehicles were big trucks, in other cases they were airplanes, and in other cases they were in balloons, and they could pass these disease-laden mosquitoes to a target area and release them. And what happened in the Gulf War, the Iraqis had taken Chinese Scud missiles, and they had adapted these to carry the mycoplasma as a disease agent, along with a number of other disease agents. They mixed the disease agents up in order to confuse diagnosis and to present with a wide variety of disease conditions. And the Iraqis were able to fire the Scud missiles over Allied positions. Now, we know this from first-hand experience, because the chairperson of our Canadian Gulf War Veterans Committee, Captain Louise Richard, formerly of the Royal Canadian Navy, was in Iraq during the first Gulf War. And she was working in a forward field hospital. And suddenly there were alarms going off indicating an air raid. And then they were aware of the fact that several thousand feet in the air, a Scud missile had exploded. But there was no metal coming down on them and killing them. It seemed that there was just the explosion, and that was it. But the biological test devices that they had scattered around all began to sound the alarm. There was a biological attack underway, and what was included in that attack, from all our evidence, was, among other things, the Mycoplasma fermentans. Well, Captain Louise Richard got ill that night, and she has never been well since. After about 2 weeks, her hair began to fall out by the handful. She began to menstruate most radically and irregularly, and she had to have a hysterectomy. She was nauseous most of the time and lost her appetite for almost every kind of food. She became extremely fatigued and disabled, and when she came back to Canada, she was obviously a victim of Gulf War syndrome. So she had her blood tested because the Canadian military would not test it for her. They said, "You're not sick, there's no such thing as Gulf War illness, and you're just imagining it, and we will not do any tests that you come up with." Now, we had said to her that, look, we're very certain that there was a mycoplasma involved in these attacks. She had her blood tested and has had them tested on several times since. She has 5 different species of mycoplasma in her blood. And she is tragically ill. And she is ill with a mycoplasma-involved disease. Now, where did it come from? Obviously, the scuds, which they thought had exploded harmlessly overhead, didn't explode harmlessly. They exploded and blew out this combination, this cocktail of disease agents, including the evidence is mustard gas. And the mycoplasma infected people who had a genetic predisposition to infection. Because the mycoplasma can't infect everybody. The mycoplasma depends upon a certain genetic predisposition in individuals before it can go and do its harm. And Louise Richard was disabled by a mycoplasma attack. Now, that is what we mean by direct biological involvement.
Okay, Donald.
Yes.
So then I understand you're implying this is airborne.
You get not implying. I'm stating clear out.
Oh, right. Sorry.
That, that there's the airborne, there's the insect vector, especially the mosquito, which we also know a very large amount about, because when they learned they could infect mosquitoes and let mosquitoes out to carry this disease agent, the mosquitoes could bite a victim. The victim could become ill with a bacterial disease, but no sign of the bacteria. And we know that very, very well because the United States government, we have learned and we have all the records we need, said to the Canadian government, "Will you breed 100 million mosquitoes a month for your military and our military and British military, and will you have these 100 million mosquitoes a month contaminated with various disease agents at Queen's University in Kingston?" And we have a man there by the name of Dr. G.B. Reed. He is a member of our group, cabal or whatever, and he will supervise the contamination of these mosquitoes with various disease agents, including Brucella abortus and other Brucella species. And the government of Canada said, "Yes, we'll do that." So in Belleville, Ontario, Canada, they established the Dominion Parasite Laboratory, and they started breeding mosquitoes. And every month they delivered 100 million mosquitoes to Queen's University in Kingston, and Dr. Reed and his fellow gangsters contaminated these mosquitoes, turned them over to the Canadian military, who shared them with the American military, and then a certain amount were shared with other allies, such as the British. And these were then taken to various communities to be tested as a biological weapon. And we know some of the test sites, and we know the results of those tests. And we know of other, for example, the type of agent that was carried by aerosol. If they were to direct that disease agent through an air conditioning system, for example, they could contaminate a certain percentage of the people who breathed that in. And the agent was the mycoplasma.
So is it your opinion then that in the Gulf War, it's a combination of aerial attack and also they let,
yes,
for argument's sake, mosquitoes loose?
Well, no. In Iraq, we have no evidence of mosquito involvement. But in Iraq, as I mentioned, there we identify the two aspects of the thing. One was the direct activity of the Iraqis with their well-trained people and their knowledge of the mycoplasma and the Regal report. Now, your senator from Michigan of a few years ago, Senator Don Regal, he conducted extensive Senate hearings, and he learned that, yes, indeed, the United States had provided Saddam Hussein, prior to the Gulf War, with not only the mycoplasma fermentans, but also provided him with West Nile virus to cause West Nile virus fever, and they also provided Saddam Hussein with Brucella abortus, which was the starting point to create their own mycoplasma fermentans. And that's the Regal report, and we have copies of it, and people are invited to get copies and read it for themselves. But there was also the indirect things that were going on. Now, this is where the Allies are even, well, are equally culpable. They're very culpable because they did not admit when the Allied soldiers were becoming ill, they did not admit that they had sold this stuff to Saddam Hussein before the war started. And that is where a lot of culpability lies, and there are various people in very prominent positions who participated in this cover-up.
You've enjoyed Black Op Radio live and archived over the web. But now there's a way to listen without having to use valuable internet time. Order the Black Op Radio Archive CD-ROM. No more network congestion or buffering, or file not found. The shows play right from your computer off the CD-ROM. Great for research or as a gift. For more details, check the website. If you believe there's more to the JFK assassination and the mystery surrounding the CIA and its covert operations, you're not alone. Meet the man Oliver Stone called X in the epic motion picture JFK. Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty comes forward with never-before-seen or heard documentation and information about JFK, the Vietnam War, the CIA, and more on a brand new CD-ROM. The collected works of Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty is an incredible offer not to be missed. For a limited time only, find the answers surrounding these issues and more with the collected works of Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty. Call now at area code 604-525-4167. That's area code 604-525-4167. Or visit the Colonel Prouty reference site on the World Wide Web. The collected works of Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty.
But they also had this other things that were going on. Now, for example, we know that most of these people who were sent over were given a whole range of vaccines before they went. But they were never told just what these vaccines were against and what they were supposed to do. And what would happen if you had a couple of vaccines together that had been never tried before? And so there were people who had been vaccinated in this way and never got over to Saudi Arabia or Iraq, who became ill with Gulf War illness. And we have reason to believe that a lot of the activities centered around such things as injecting the veterans before they went with squalene. And we know what squalene does in the human body and why they would be given it. It's related to the disease agent of Mycoplasma fermentans. So there were the two areas. There was the area of direct Iraqi biological assault on our allies, and that was Scud missile attacks. And there was something else very important that needs to be known. The Regal report shows that not only did they give Iraq the mycoplasma and train their top people in how to use it, they also gave them anthrax. Now, anthrax would have at least a 10% fatality rate. And if you have 700,000 allied forces in southern Iraq and moving towards Baghdad, and if Saddam Hussein fired Scud missiles loaded with anthrax instead of with the mycoplasma and traces of mustard gas and so on, then there would be 70,000 fatalities in Iraq among the Allied forces within a week. That is why when the Scud missiles were fired and it was detected that the mycoplasma and other agents were being dispersed, and the biological intelligence people knew this, and this was why the alarms were going off, George Bush was notified, and he knew that not only did they have that disabling mycoplasma, he knew the Iraqis had anthrax. And he knew, without having to be told, that the next volley of Scuds could be loaded with anthrax. That is why, at midnight on a particular date, which eludes me at the moment, but I've got it here in our documents, when General Schwarzkopf reported by phone to George Bush and told about the attacks and the mycoplasma, which they knew were coming down, George Bush said, stop the attack. Prepare to withdraw from Iraq as quickly as you're able to do it. And so halfway to Baghdad in the first Gulf War, the Allied forces stopped dead in their tracks. They began withdrawing as rapidly as they could get out of there. A number of the people coming back were ill with mycoplasmal infections, i.e. Gulf War illnesses, with all the ramification that that carries, because the mycoplasma not only causes chronic fatigue, but in its certain advanced stages it causes deadly diseases such as amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. The George Bush, Ronald Reagan administration knew that not only had the Iraqis been provided with disabling agents, they had been provided with lethal agents, and that is also in the Donald Regal Senate report. It's not something we've made up or speculated about. And so the Allies withdrew from Iraq, left Saddam Hussein there until George Bush Sr.'s son was in power, and he was intent on destroying Saddam Hussein and Iraq, and he was going to use, of course, the weapons of mass destruction, which they knew had been provided to the Iraqis because they had been provided by the United States. But he also knew, and if he didn't know, then the intelligence services of the United States are a disgrace to any nation. If he didn't know that the Iraqis had largely destroyed their weapons of mass destruction, because Saddam Hussein may be a lunatic, but he's not crazy. He knew that as long as he maintained weapons of mass destruction, that he was subject to international boycotting at the very least, as he was suffering at the time, and he was leaving himself open to attack. So their evidence is that Iraq decided, okay, having these weapons is no big gain for us because we don't have an army that we can use them against. And the evidence is that these weapons of mass destruction were destroyed, and George Bush Jr. went ahead with the invasion of Iraq mainly because he wanted to get powerful control of Iraqi oil, but also there would be a certain amount of family pride. Dad went in there, did half the job, and then pulled out very rapidly, and 100,000 or more veterans are ill with Gulf War illness. And he let on, and he continues to let on, that Iraq was somehow tied in with the Saudi Arabian and Egyptian and one Lebanese terrorist who hijacked planes on September 11th and flew them into the trade towers and so on.
Well, Professor Scott, you make reference to a lot of documents, and I'm wondering if anybody in your circles is planning to release them in the form of a book.
Well, we've issued certain books already, and we do this regularly. For example, when we first started off with our Common Cause Medical Research Foundation, and we discovered the role of brucellosis as the antecedent to the mycoplasma, we published a book called The Brucellosis Triangle, the triangle being Washington, D.C., and New York and Fort Detrick. And in that triangle, geographic triangle, were the institutions and laboratories and so on that had developed Brucella bacteriological agents and actually created weapons that were taken into inventory by the U.S. military. So we published a book, Brucellosis Triangle, sells for $19.95 American, plus $2 postage, and it tells the story of the brucellosis coming from the barnyard into the realm of biological weaponry, and it helps people understand, for example, where chronic fatigue comes from as a result of this brucella derivative, and also multiple sclerosis. I don't know whether you know it or not, but the United States military knew that an awful lot of their people were handling brucella or brucellosis weaponry, and they knew that brucellosis can be a factor in causing multiple sclerosis. And we have U.S. government military documents given to veterans of the U.S. military who are engaged in this work, and they have provided copies of them to us. And those documents state that if within 2 years of leaving the military, a veteran develops multiple sclerosis, his disease will be deemed to be a consequence of his service in the U.S. military, and he will be eligible for disability pension.
That's a pretty big admission right there.
Oh, is it ever? And we have the actual documents and all the supporting documents that went along with it. It was given to us by one of the veterans who was given the documents because he had been trained in biological warfare, and when he got out, they said, now, you know, you might become ill with multiple sclerosis, and if you do, don't go off crying to the media and all the rest of it. Just come quietly to the military, and you, because of the nature of your service, and the fact that you are diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, you will get a disability pension. Our brucellosis triangle contains references to that. Then we followed it up with another book called The Extremely Unfortunate Skull Valley Incident, or for short form, we just call it Skull Valley. And the title derives from the fact that on June the 9th, 1969, Dr. Donald MacArthur, Chief Biological Weapons Research Director for the Pentagon, met with 12 U.S. congressmen. Now, these congressmen and the Pentagon met in secret, and at that meeting, Dr. MacArthur revealed to the congressmen that not only were they working on a disabling agent, they were working on a lethal agent, which he said did not naturally occur, and which was effective because it would be refractory to the human immune system upon which we defend to protect ourselves against disease. In other words, the persons have an acquired deficiency, immune deficiency condition. So in those meetings of June the 9th, we learned that the disabling agent, which causes chronic fatigue, was on the way, and the lethal agent, which causes AIDS, was on the way, and that all that Dr. MacArthur needed was another $10 million, and he said that by 1980, at the latest, they would have these two disease agents at work.
You're listening to Black Op Radio.
Well, when did chronic fatigue first hit the big headlines? When did it first come out in large epidemics? 1981. And when was AIDS accepted into the lexicon of the American medical group and the military and of the media and so on? 1981. MacArthur got his $10 million from the congressman, and the U.S. government went ahead and created the two disease agents. One, chronic fatigue caused by the Mycoplasma fermentans, and we could tell you scientifically how that works. The other, AIDS, starts off with the Mycoplasma fermentans, but only as a cofactor, because the Mycoplasma fermentans causes the cells of the individuals infected to become less immune defensive, and allows retroviruses which where the RNA is able to take over the DNA of their host and manufacture more of themselves. That required the cofactor, and the cofactor is a Vizsla virus of sheep. There's no element of truth at all in the claim that somehow or other a green monkey in Africa bit a black woman and gave her a simian immune deficiency virus. This whole idea of blaming the disease on some poor creature in Africa being bitten by a monkey, and then she in turn had sex, which somehow she had sex, or some of her partners supposedly had sex with a Canadian airline steward who had flown over to Europe, and he became infected with her simian-inspired human immune deficiency, and he came back to North America, and some reason or other he apparently turned homosexual and flew to New York, San Francisco, and Los Angeles, and had some 2,500 sexual encounters with gay friends. And so this marvelous story that they made up accounted for how the AIDS turned up in Africa and simultaneously turned up in New York City, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. And they even were good enough to identify the name of this Canadian Airlines steward, Gaetan Duga, I think they said his name was. And we have gone over all the evidence that we can possibly lay our hands on. We have some excellent evidence. The plan to, first of all, put the disease agent into the African population was well established a number of years before when they first began developing the mycoplasma. And then they knew they had a problem. What if the world hears that a bunch of black heterosexual people of Africa are dying of some strange new disease? There are a lot of people, despite my cynicism expressed at the beginning, there are a lot of people who would say, let's do something about that. But in those days of 1980 and 82 and 84 and so on, there was a more homophobic society in the United States, Canada, and Great Britain. And the reality was recognized that if you infect the gay population of North America with the same disease agent, and then you say that those people are ill with AIDS because of their sinful lifestyle, then the people will say, well, look, if they're going to engage in this gay plague activity, homosexual activity, it is not a responsibility of government. And it's very, very ironic, almost beautifully ironic, if you don't mind me saying so, that Ronald Reagan, in his campaign for his second term of presidency, said that there will not be 1 cent of taxpayers' money go towards research into AIDS, because he was claiming that these sinful people with their homosexual tendencies didn't deserve it. And we now also have a document which is a patent of the mycoplasma, patented by the U.S. government. And in that patent, it lists the diseases with which the mycoplasma is involved. And the first one they list is AIDS. But you know, after listing about 25 other diseases down at the bottom, the last one they list is Alzheimer's. And I think it's so ironic that the president who said in the early stages of these awful diseases, not 1 cent of taxpayers' money will go towards research of AIDS, he also cut off research into the role of the mycoplasma in Alzheimer's. And our foundation has clearly established a dramatic link between Alzheimer's and the mycoplasma.
Wow, that's very interesting. And I know you don't have a website right now. It would be very interesting to see some of these documents posted on the internet. Anybody made that suggestion to you?
Oh, yes. Now, you see, I'm 80 years old, as I told you. And I thought it was really a big thing when I went from the fountain pen to a typewriter. And then when I went from a typewriter to a computer, well, that was helpful, extended my ability to do a lot of work. But I had a brief experience with the web and emails and all of that sort of thing, and I was just overwhelmed with, well, a lot of it was really junk, you know, stuff about how AIDS came from outer space and all the rest of it.
Oh, yeah.
So I terminated any of those links. But there were people in our foundation who said, hey, look, we've got to have a website and so on. And I said, well, if you want one, you go ahead and establish it. And we had one for a period of time. It did very well until the lady who ran it for us tragically became ill herself and had to give it up. And recently, another volunteer in New York State has volunteered to create a website, and she gave me the site code to access it, and I could give you that if you wanted. And she's just setting this up now. And what she's going to do is take documents that we've got and put them on this site so that people can access them and download them and study the evidence that we've got. They can do that on their own.
Okay, well, very good. Well, when she's up and running, I'll keep in touch with you and over time. And when that's up and running, maybe we can put a link to that so that our listeners can
can go check it out. And in the meantime, also, if you want another site to put up, I'd be perfectly happy to post a few documents for you if you like. So,
okay, well, we could email stuff over to you. When we produce our quarterly journal, now each quarter we bring out a journal which covers all of the degenerative diseases that are involved with the mycoplasma. And the amazing thing is that the mycoplasma, and this is according to the patent, patented by the U.S. government itself, by the Institute of Pathology, they state in that patent that that people infected with the mycoplasma will be people who have been diagnosed as having, and they list the disease list I mentioned to you earlier, AIDS or AIDS-related complex, chronic fatigue syndrome, Wegener's disease, sarcoidosis, lupus, respiratory distress syndrome, and so on. And then they get right to the very end and they say, and even degenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's. So in our journal, each quarter, we try to allude to one, two, three, four, or more of these degenerative diseases, and that's why we call the Journal of Degenerative Diseases. But also in each one, we try to focus on a particular disease. Now, the one that's coming out on Tuesday, June the 22nd, focuses on AIDS. We list in that special issue of the journal the people who developed the AIDS cofactors. We know the politicians who advanced it. We know the scientists who did the actual work. We know the media, parts of the media which we call media assets, who agreed to not present the truth to the world in order to allow the military and the biological researchers to do their thing without having to account for what they were doing in the public realm of politics and news stories and so on. So on June the 22nd, just a few days from now, there will be the special issue of the Journal of Degenerative Diseases, and that is available to your listeners for $10 U.S. plus $2 postage, and it tells you who was involved. It isn't speculation. It is actual scientific documents that we have accessed and that have been provided to us. For example, the program actually got underway significantly in 1952 when Eisenhower appointed Nelson Rockefeller as Undersecretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. And Rockefeller used his position then to tie the public health agencies, the National Institutes for Health and the Centers for Disease Control, in with the military in this whole effort, because Nelson Rockefeller and his brother John D. Rockefeller III are eugenics fanatics. And then the whole thing went into a hiatus when Kennedy was elected, because Kennedy detested the whole idea of population control and eugenics and all that sort of thing. And so for 3.5 years, or 3 years at any rate, very, very little was done until Lyndon Johnson took over. And Lyndon Johnson, when he took over, only $6 million a year was being spent by the government of the United States on population control. And he says in his biography called The Vantage Point, he said, by the time I left office, we were spending $115 million a year worldwide on population control. And we know what they were doing. Then he was succeeded by Richard Nixon. And Richard Nixon appointed Henry Kissinger, who is probably the arch criminal of the world, as his national security advisor. And Henry Kissinger, of course, was a protege of John D. Rockefeller III and of Nelson Rockefeller. And he established a what they called the Special Virus Cancer Program, wherein they pretended to look for the cause and cure of cancer, but were actually blending in with all the cancer research they were doing, and they did a lot of work in that area, but it was used as a cover to go full bore into the creation of the AIDS and chronic fatigue pathogens. And these special cancer programs were published annually, and then after Watergate, Nixon and Richard Helms of the CIA and his deputy Gottlieb decided they better gather up all of these reports on the cancer so-called program and shred them. And they did their best to do that. They asked the people who had been sent them to send them back, and they were shredded. They went to libraries and they found them, and they took them out and they shredded them and the rest of it. We, in our foundation, have been very, very fortunate in being able to find from various sources practically all of these reports. And it's something rather funny, we think. One of the reports is numbered Progress Report Number 8. And I was on a radio program one day two or three years ago, and I told the listeners how we had this Progress Report Number 8 and how it was a cover for the development of AIDS and chronic fatigue syndrome. And when I got home to Sudbury from where I had been broadcasting, Windsor, Ontario, there was a phone call from the United States Senate. Dr. Susan Conrath of the Government Reform Committee had phoned my home here in Sudbury and left her number. So I phoned Dr. Susan Conrath of the United States Senate and told her who I was, and she said, a couple of senators were into my office, and they told me that they had heard that you had a copy of the Special Virus Cancer Program Progress Report Number 8. Is that true? And I said, yes, I do have. And she said, well, my goodness, we have searched the archives of Washington for that document, and nowhere can we find it anywhere. Would you make a copy and send it to us? And I did, some 400 pages. And I thought it was rather interesting that a retired professor in Sudbury, Canada, would be sending a confidential U.S. government document to the U.S. government. And this is just to give you an idea how rare these documents were. Now, we have since that time distributed hundreds of copies of this to researchers, and they're mind-boggled by what they find and what we've found. And it's just one example of the kind of documentation that our foundation has been able to use, which permits us to say AIDS was created in laboratories basically in Fort Detrick, but also in many universities such as the University of Wisconsin, which had received great contributions from the Department of Defense for various kinds of research. And guess who was president of, or chancellor of Wisconsin? Dr. Donna Shalala, who later became Secretary of Health in the Clinton administration. And when these great epidemics of chronic fatigue and AIDS were doing their worst, Donna Shalala was strangely silent. And most people kind of, well, not most people, most people didn't even notice that she was. But those who were in the know realized that she was not doing her job. And we found out why. Because she was chancellor of one of the universities that was doing the research. And so Dr. Shalala was part of the university group that are in on what had gone on and what continues to go on.
There's a tremendous amount of conflict of interest in these matters, isn't there?
Oh, very much so. You see, the thing is that anybody who wants a career in science in the United States or Canada or Britain, Australia and so on, doesn't dare say what we're saying because they would not get tenure in their university. They would not get government grants to do research. They would be shut out of all these great mainstream activities, which are, in many many scientific terms, a very, very, very solid, reputable science. But there are certain aspects of that science that they dare not tread, certain paths they dare not go down. And one of the paths is none of these people are able, without risking their careers, to objectively look at the reality that acquired immune deficiency syndrome was developed in the laboratories of the United States and some of their allies, Canada being one of them. We've got our gangsters too, as we've established in our journal on many occasions. And people in Britain and people in Israel and people in Australia, they were involved as well. But the mainstream won't publicize this. For example, our last issue of our journal, the one that's coming out on the 22nd, is focused primarily on AIDS. The full story on AIDS. If you want to know where AIDS came from, you want to know who did it. And we name the people, and we tell what they did. And we have all the evidence that we need to support it.
Donald?
Yes?
Before you continue, I don't think you mentioned how we could get a copy of that. How do people subscribe to that?
Okay, they can subscribe to the journal for $25 a year by writing a check or sending a money order for $25 to Common Cause Medical Research Foundation. Now, don't spell all that out. Just initialize it. CCMRF, Common Cause Medical Research Foundation, CCMRF. Box 133, Station B as in Bob, Sudbury, Canada, S-U-D-B-U-R-Y, Sudbury, Canada. And our zip code, which is a little fancier than the American zip code, P as in Peter, 3, E as in Edward, 4, N as in Norman, 5. P3E4N5. Send $25 and we will give you a year's subscription to our journal, which is 4 copies. It's published quarterly. If you want your subscription to start with the special AIDS edition, get it in right away. If you would like the previous issue, which focused on Alzheimer's, for we have some dramatically significant data that demonstrates that Alzheimer's disease in seniors is related to adenoidal disease in children. Children from age 3 or 4 or 5 up until the age of 18, 19, 20 frequently develop adenoid disease. And these adenoids are usually cut out surgically and thrown away. We have learned that the agent which causes the adenoids to fall apart is none other than the Mycoplasma fermentans. And we have also learned that the disease agent in the hippocampus of the human brain that causes the brains of seniors with Alzheimer's to fall apart, peace to President Reagan, is caused by the same mycoplasmal agency. And then, when we did some more research, it was so obvious I mean, this is a remarkable thing about discoveries in history. People will live with something that needs to be discovered for 2, 3, 4, 5 centuries and not recognize it. But as soon as somebody recognizes it and says it, everybody says, oh yes, isn't that magical? Well, let's go back to adenoids. It's at the top, the adenoids are at the top of the nasal cavity. So when you breathe air in, it goes by the adenoids. What do the adenoids do? They take a little sample of that air to see what's heading down for the lungs. And when they detect the mycoplasma, if there's too much of it, they begin to deteriorate and doctors cut them out. Now, take another look at the nasal cavity. And right in front of the adenoids is what's called the olfactory receptor neuron. It is the little hole that allows smell or odor to enter the brain so you can tell the difference between an apple and an orange by smelling it. It's right next door to the adenoids. So the same air that causes the adenoids to deteriorate when it carries mycoplasma, some of it goes through the receptor neuron of the olfactory system and right along the olfactory node into the area of the hippocampus. Now, the hippocampus is a significant part of the brain, and it takes years and years and years for enough of the mycoplasma to build to a critical stage. The adenoids, on the other hand, are just about the size of your small fingernail. And they get diseased much more easily. So the same agent, the mycoplasma fermentans, that causes adenoids in children, builds up in the hippocampus of the brain. And then when the person gets to be about 55 or 65 or so, and when they have a trauma, bang, some kind of trauma, it can be a psychological trauma, such as the death of a friend, or it could be a physical trauma, such as a rear-end automobile accident, or a fall on the ice, or whatever, the mycoplasma goes to work. And we know how it works. And how it works is this. Because it's just a particle of a bacterial DNA, it has no organelles to manufacture its own growth requirements. So what does it do? It steals them from the host cells that it's in. So it begins taking the host cells apart, molecule of the hippocampus by molecule, until the cell wall deteriorates to the point where it collapses. And that spreads more of the mycoplasma into more of the cells, and they begin to collapse. So it's a progressive disease, as you saw when President Reagan became ill a number of years ago, following either when he had a fall from his horse, or it might have been initiated by the bullet wound he sustained in his first term. It sometimes takes 5 years for the mycoplasmal degeneration to begin to show. And it was somewhere into his second term that President Reagan began manifesting forgetfulness and dropping off to sleep at cabinet meetings and so on. And it was shortly after he retired from the presidency that he went on the television with his great tragic announcement that he had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. The mycoplasma that was taking his brain apart, cell by cell, was the same mycoplasma that takes the adenoids apart cell by cell. And so we have the last issue, if people wanted to start with that, if they've got a friend or relative or they feel at risk themselves for Alzheimer's, tell us you want to start with the Alzheimer edition.
Okay, I'm going to put a link to that up on our webpage next to this interview. So people who didn't get that will have that. And I, for one, I'm going to sign up for that. Now, I have a couple of questions that came in via email, and I just wanted to get to them quickly. One troubling thing I found about the AIDS scenario, when they did have Magic Johnson as their spokesman,
yes,
he seemed to be hushed up and nothing happened. And I kind of made a quiet prediction. I wrote it down on a little piece of paper and tacked it to the wall here, that although he was diagnosed with AIDS, he would never die, because somehow maybe there was a cure, maybe there was some kind of hush thing going on. And I just thought, you know what, I bet you he was supposed to be campaigning on behalf of AIDS, and then he was just quietly whisked aside. Do you have any comment on that?
Yes, there's two things. One, there are cofactors at work in AIDS. One is the mycoplasma, which causes the immune system to be compromised. And the immune system, of course, is the defense system. Once it's compromised, the second factor, which is an adaptation of the Vizsna virus, and if you see pictures of the Vizsna virus and the so-called human immune deficiency virus, you'll see they're identical, because actually one is the same as the other. The HIV is actually Vizsna virus. If you have a sufficiently well-developed immune system, that although you become infected and you're tested and you reveal that there is this virus, which people call HIV, and there actually is no such thing, it's the Vizsna virus, it's not HIV. If people found with that, they're said to be HIV positive, and they shorten this up by saying, I've got AIDS, as Johnson did. But the immune system is so powerful and so healthy, despite the mycoplasma infection, that the full-blown disease does not present. All the opportunistic diseases that would otherwise present in ordinary people who don't eat right, don't sleep right, work too hard, live in environments that are poor, use intravenous drugs and so on, they don't have anywhere near the defense that Magic Johnson had and probably still has. That's the one thing. There's another thing we've discovered, and we've never been able to get very much information on it because the government's very close-lipped about it. But the United States Senate, when they were cross-examining their biological warfare researchers in one of their secret sessions, and this was later then made public under freedom of information, and some of it was made public by order of the senators and so on, the principal researchers said to the senators about one disease agent they were working on, he said this, and this is very significant. He said, since we now have an antidote for it, we can go into production. Now, what does that mean?
Well, that says a lot right there.
Boy, doesn't it? That says that we don't start producing until we know what to, how to control it. Oh. And this is quite possibly the situation with AIDS. It's quite possible that they have antidotes which address the mycoplasma fermentans and hence slow its damage to the immune system down. And they might also know how to address the Vizsna virus, i.e. HIV, so that people in the inner circle whom they want to protect are protected.
Yeah, that's something that Colonel Prouty mentioned to me. And also, to underscore that, he also mentioned about this MacArthur business. He said it was a trait of these guys to do the research and almost present their request for funding when they already had it going.
Oh, absolutely. Right. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I'm telling you, we have solid evidence that they were using AIDS cofactors, mycoplasma and Vizsna, 10 years before they ever requested Congress for the extra $10 million. The reason they went to Congress was they were getting ready to unload it on the world in a major way. And that arch-criminal Kissinger, he was going to cover his own butt. He wanted to make sure that there was officially on the record, albeit secretly, that Congress had approved this. He didn't bother telling them that it was years before that they had first tried this out and found that it worked. And that was, it was initiated,
wow,
as they say, by Nelson Rockefeller in 52. He wasn't able to do too much, but we know what he did. And then they went full bore, as it were, in the time of Lyndon Johnson, who was also as criminal as Richard Nixon. Nixon, you know, he had his Watergate and everything, but and Johnson managed to elude that.
Okay, well, Donald, that's great. I have another couple of questions I want to get to you quick before
sure.
we run out of time. And I'm going to have to dig up some of my Fletcher Prouty interviews, because I know he spoke to me about this, but it wasn't the topic at the time. But I do have some interesting comments from him as well. Now, the other comment was, do you have any comments or information about the hepatitis B vaccination program?
Oh, yes, very much. As you may know, the hepatitis, well, A, B, C, and there's a variety of other species. The major work that really launched this into becoming a serious health consideration was done by a fellow by the name of Dr. Fritz Dehnhardt. Now, Fritz Dehnhardt had come over from Germany after the war, and he began working pretty full-time with a criminal by the name of Hilary Koprowski. And Koprowski and Dehnhardt were both on the payroll of the Rockefellers. And when they were developing the AIDS cofactors, they were also working to develop the hepatitis agents. And in order to test them, they didn't want to start off testing them on witting human beings, because it might be too fatal or too quickly. They went over to Camp Lindi in Congo, where there was a camp established by the financed by the government of Belgium and the government of the United States, and where they had taken a whole bunch of captured chimpanzees, and they were testing not only a so-called polio vaccine, which they did. They actually did test polio vaccines on these chimps, because the chimp has the closest immune system defense as to humans of any other creature. They also were testing the AIDS cofactors. But Fritz Dehnhardt was there testing none other than hepatitis disease agents. And last I heard, Fritz had gone back to Germany. But he was part and parcel of that whole era of AIDS and hepatitis. And it was he who provided the quote-unquote hepatitis vaccines to the gay population of New York, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. Now, they blame the AIDS epidemic in those gay communities on this poor old Canadian airline steward, Gaston Dugas. But actually what had happened in 1976, after Dehnhardt had done all his research work on chimpanzees, and they also did it on other people too, prisoners in prisons and children in mental institutions and that sort of thing, they decided they would have a free vaccination program in New York, San Francisco, and Los Angeles, and they advertised among the gay population, your lifestyle exposes you to hepatitis. If you want to avoid hepatitis, come and get this free vaccine paid for courtesy of the United States government. And several hundred, in fact thousands, of gay men went and got this vaccine against hepatitis provided by Dehnhardt and George Merck's pharmaceutical company and so on. And the trouble with it was, within a year, some began to present with AIDS, and within 5 years, 60% of the people who took this hepatitis shot had AIDS. So the whole thing is part of the complex of biological research built primarily around the lethal AIDS and the disabling chronic fatigue, but also they had experiments with hepatitis and certain other disease agents.
You're listening to Black Op Radio.
Boy, oh boy, I mean, this is so criminal. I guess it's no wonder that you're not getting a lot of help on some levels getting this information out, because there are just too many guilty parties.
Oh, it's terrible. In fact, in our special issue of the journal, and I mentioned to you, if people send $10 plus $2 for postage and handling, we will send that full report to them, or they can subscribe to the journal for $25 and get it to start with, and that's quite a bargain for them. We say in there, after we cite all of this evidence, we can't afford recrimination and attempts to go into class action suits and long drawn out trials and all the rest of it. What we're going to have worldwide is a truth and reconciliation committee similar to that in South Africa when apartheid collapsed, and Archbishop Tutu and others in the new black South African government created the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where they said to people who had been involved in the terrible crimes of apartheid, and these included spreading the AIDS virus, you know, that was part of it, they said, look, if you come forward voluntarily and tell us all you know, you will go out of the room a free person. Live with your conscience, but tell us all you know so we can get on the road to finding the cures and the way to get this under control. And thousands of scientists and politicians took advantage of that and were freed from prosecution. We're going to have to do that in the world. And we're going to have to say to people like Robert Gallo, and Brian Mahi, and Thomas Merrigan, and others who are still alive, who were involved in all of this, and we have all the records, and we're sending them a copy of our report, by the way, so that they can't plead, well, they didn't know what we were saying about them, because they know what we're saying, and they don't answer, because they know we've got the evidence.
Well, that's a very interesting point you bring out about, sort of granting an amnesty, because I think the truth is more important than punishing these people if we can just get the information out so that we can start to deal with these situations. That's
yes.
A priority here, really.
Well, we're pretty sure from our research that a person who is tested as HIV positive, what is being demonstrated is the presence either of fragments of the mycoplasma or of the virus, or actually of both, that if that person is responded to with certain diet changes and certain antibacterial agents such as doxycycline or tetracycline, that they can have their condition ameliorated or stop dead in its tracks without having to spend these thousands of dollars per year that the large pharmaceutical companies now demand in order to provide the treatments, the very expensive, sophisticated treatments. We think that the disease can be limited, contained, or even stopped with a much more economic response when we really establish to the satisfaction of the people in positions to do something about it the true nature of the disease.
Yes, okay, well said. Now, to actually to subscribe to the Journal of Degenerative Diseases, should the check be made out to CCMRF?
Yes.
Okay, very good. We'll make sure that that information is posted next to this interview, and highly encourage all our listeners to subscribe and get this information. You're going to get it right from the source here.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, Donald, I'm already making out my check right now, so I'll have mine in the mail tomorrow morning.
Thank you.
We've kept you longer than an hour, but it's been very interesting, and the topic could take 5 hours just to
get it. Well, you know, in the period of time that we've been talking, almost 700 people have died of AIDS. And frankly, Anita and Len, I have to tell you, and through you, I have to tell your listeners that United States, Canada, Great Britain, Australia, South Africa, and Israel are complicit in these crimes. We have all kinds of evidence. We have faced them with it. And if you go to bed at night and you don't say to yourself, what have I done to stop this AIDS tragedy, then you're doing the same thing that thousands and thousands of Germans did when they went to bed at night and the furnaces in the Auschwitz were blowing away and burning the bodies of gassed Jews and gypsies and so on. You're as criminal as they were, and
well,
we've got to stop it.
I'd like to pose a question, and I'm not trying to soft foot around it, but in your opinion, what difference is there between the government and these corporations? Because I know when you spoke of Merck, I have several anecdotes about that company, and I'm just wondering, is there a difference? Are they one and the same, or is this really a corporation?
Well,
comment on that, then.
There's two things. First of all, there's the public company, Merck, Sharp, and Dohme, and then there's the public government, such as the government of Canada, the government of the United States, and these appear to be separate entities. But our research demonstrates that at a very subtle and powerful level, the influences that direct both of them are very solidly there. We, because of our stand on all this, get insights into this that the average person doesn't get. For example, I told you about my dear friend Captain Louise Richard, who was tragically injured in Saudi Arabia during the First Gulf War, in Iraq during the First Gulf War. And she tested positive for the mycoplasma, so she sent these results to the commander-in-chief of the Canadian military, General Baril. And so General Baril wrote a memo to the Major Timothy Cook of the Canadian Military Medical Group. And he said, Dear Major, is there any truth that the mycoplasma might be involved in Gulf War illnesses? And Major Tim Cook wrote back a reply saying, no, General, there's no truth in this at all. The only people who believe this are the conspiracy buffs, blah, 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 blah. And he sent that off to General Baril. Now, somebody was good enough to send us both the original memo and Major Cook's reply. But here's the critical thing. Down in the lower left-hand corner of Major Timothy Cook's reply, it says, carbon copy, you know, CC, Captain Kenneth C. Hyams. And then it had underneath Bethesda Naval Station, Maryland. And I phoned Bethesda. And I said, do you have a Captain Hyams? And the operator said, yes, we do. I'll put you through to him. Well, that was nice. Bang, right through. And this voice came on, Hyams speaking. And I said, is this Captain Kenneth C. Hyams? He said, yes, it is. And I said, do you know Major Timothy Cook? And he said, yes, I do. Why? Who's calling? What do you want to know that for? And I said, that's all I needed to know. Thank you very much. He said, who's calling? What are you calling about? And I said, I just told you, I just wanted to make sure that you were the guy that, and confirm that you're there. And I hung up. Now, the point is this. Timothy Cook took a memo to the commanding officer of the military of Canada and sent a copy of it to a guy who was working in the biological research establishment of the United States Navy in Bethesda, Maryland.
Absolutely did not miss me on that point. Very, very interesting. Why would they be keeping him updated if there was nothing to this?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And so it goes. The people who are suffering are victims of a gang of crooks, gangsters. People, tragically enough, some of these people actually think they're doing the world a favor. You know, they feel that they're God's gift to humanity to pare down the population.
Yeah, well, some of us actually think otherwise. So.
Yes, indeed. And that's why at my stage, every day I get up, I make it a point of going to work and working most of the day, researching, reading, writing, studying, reporting, talking with people who are ill and that sort of thing, because we are at the cutting edge of the greatest crime in the history of humanity. 8,000 people a day are dying of AIDS. An equal number are becoming ill with the degenerative diseases such as chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, sarcoidosis, and Alzheimer's. And we know from all the evidence we have where it's coming, where it came from, and how it continues to persist, and how the mass media of the establishment will not put down boo about it.
Well, you really do hammer the point home very effectively. Very effectively. And I think, well, I expected this to be a very informative interview, and I see that Len is more than impressed with the amount of information that you've provided us. And we thank you so much for sticking around an extra half an hour, because I realize it's getting pretty late where you are.
Yeah. And well, it's backed up a lot of research that I have done, but not in any kind of formal effort. Being interested in political conspiracy leads you to different avenues, and this was one of them I had not really investigated too much, but certain things have popped up with Merck and hepatitis B, and also the $10 million and MacArthur, just a bunch of things that I'm going to have to go back and make available now.
And you mentioned Colonel Prouty before. I recall him commenting on how there were little innuendos in the Pentagon about how AIDS was being directed. And it was the impression being that it was a controlled release in Africa.
Yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, if I don't want to speak, so I'll just look into it and I'll look that up. But Professor, we'd like to know then, in this last 5 minutes or so, if there's anything that you didn't get to you'd like to bring up at this point, and we'd sure like to have you on again in the future.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. There's so much that I won't try to single anything out. I'll just say that our book, The Brucellosis Triangle, is like an account of our initial discoveries in the first few years, 2 or 3 years. But although it's kind of dated as far as we're concerned, it's brand new to an awful lot of people, and it's a good starting point. And $19.95 plus $3 postage will get people a copy of it. Or Skull Valley is $24.95 plus $3 postage.
Now, where are those available? At the same address?
Yes, CCMRF, Box 133, Station B, Sudbury, Canada, P3E4N5.
Okay, very good. We can make a note of the books also then, in addition to the Journal of Degenerative Diseases.
Thank you.
Encourage people very much to get those. Okay, well, as you said, there's so much more to say. We'll have to actually pick this up again some point in the future.
Thank you, and we'll always be happy to report on any of the issues that we look at in our special issues, and it's been good talking to you.
It's been an absolute pleasure to discuss this with you.
Well, thank you very much. Good night.
Good night. Well, this has gone on quite a bit longer than we anticipated, so Jim Fetzer's not going to be coming on. He was, I understand, listening in from his end, and so we will be back next week with more Black Op Radio.
Sure. Keep the emails coming. Thanks for the people who appreciate our new photo.
Yeah.
Caught us at a
mid-danger.
Okay, until next week.
You've been listening to Black Op Radio, broadcasting weekly from the Fiasco Brothers Recording Studio in Vancouver, Canada. You're listening to the Fiasco Brothers Radio Network.